All right, good morning. Welcome everybody to Bio 241. It's May 10th. We're going to finish up cardiovascular chapter today, move on to respiratory system today. All right, and we're going to just maybe review a little bit, starting with the hormones. And we're going to go on to the very last hormone, atrial natriuretic hormone, and then move on to the respiratory chapter. But before we start talking about all that stuff, let's look at the schedule. And let's see what's on the schedule. All right, so today's May 10th. We might get into respiratory system. Probably have to carry on with that on Monday a little bit. I mean, on Tuesday a little bit. And on Tuesday, and as a matter of fact, on Monday and Tuesday, I won't be on campus. So you're going to have a guest lecturer on Tuesday. Okay, but I will be back on Thursday to finish up urinary system. So my guess, the chapters that we're going to have on the last exam will be respiratory and renal physiology. Oh, and cardiac output. Okay, so cardiovascular, respiratory, and renal. So those three chapters will be on the last test. Okay, so chapters 14, 16, and 17. Now, don't forget, you still have the weekly modules in Blackboard with all these chapters. And I frequently talk to students throughout the semester saying, oh yeah, I know there's a weekly quiz, but I forgot this week there was a weekly quiz. All right, those statements are kind of incongruent, right? If you know there's a weekly quiz every week, don't forget that there's a weekly quiz every week. Okay, so even though it's kind of the end of the semester, a lot of things going on, please remember you can take an online quiz an unlimited number of times before the deadline, but zero times after the deadline. And I'm sure many students are completed the class already, at least the online component of the class. They've taken all their quizzes. All the quizzes should be open. All right, so that's the deal. Does anybody have a question on that? Okay, and the date of the last exam is May 24th, which is when? Oh, it's not till Thursday, okay, of finals week. I think that's helpful, okay. And that's the Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. Right. Okay, then I'll get the grades calculated really quick right after that. I won't be on campus much during this summer semester, but I will be back on campus after Memorial Day on Tuesday for graduation. And I think I asked if students were graduating. Anybody graduating in here this year? Raise your hand. No. Okay. So if you want to see me about a grade or something, you might have to wait and see me in the fall. Okay, or you can email me. All right, so let's get the pointer options going right here. I'm happy with that. I'm happy with this. All right, so we talked about antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone. You should be able to answer this question right now. Which of the above hormones, of these three, are synergistic? Antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone, all right? And in particular, on the effect of blood pressure, what effect do they have on blood pressure? Antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone do what to blood pressure? Increase blood pressure, right? And then what about atrial natriuretic hormone? Antagonistic to the first two, so it's going to have a tendency to decrease blood pressure because it's going to have an opposite mechanism of action. All right, so let's slide past all of these slides right here. Oh, but I do want to point out the importance of this one right here. If there is maybe one or 10 things in this class that you should remember, this is one of those things. One of the 10. Right? Because it's the most important mechanism for what? Long-term regulation of your blood pressure. Right? Long-term regulation of blood pressure. In a little bit, we're going to talk about the most important short-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure in people, and that's just as important, but this is the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system for regulating blood pressure in the long run. Okay, atrial natriuretic hormone, I call it hormone, your book calls it peptide. I find that a little awkward, so I just call it hormone, atrial natriuretic hormone, and that just says that this natri comes from natrium. What the heck is natrium? Sodium, right? So it's the sodium ion. And when sodium leaves the body, it drags water along with it. So expanded blood volume is detected because the heart fills up with blood more, and diastolic volume increases with increasing blood volume. And there are stretch receptors in the atrium that release atrial natriuretic hormone when they are stretched. that inhibits aldosterone secretion. So if atrial natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone, that immediately should tell you that its action is to stop raising blood pressure, which is also what? The same as lowering blood pressure. Atrial natriuretic hormone also promotes salt and water excretion in the kidney to lower blood volume. And then as blood volume decreases, right, then the stretch of the heart doesn't happen quite so much. And then because of the Frank Starling law of the heart, if the end diastolic volume goes down and the heart doesn't stretch when it's filling up, what happens to contractility of the heart? As the heart stretches, the normal heart gets stronger. And as it stops stretching, the normal heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker. That's a really important thing that you should be aware of, the Frank Starling law of the heart. So, for instance, if you lacerate a blood vessel and you start to hemorrhage, you're losing blood volume, you're losing blood, and that hasn't affected your heart one way or the other, right? That injury has not affected the heart. But because of the Frank Starling law of the heart automatically starts getting weaker and weaker and weaker when you lose blood volume because of the Frank Starling law. Okay, atrial natriuretic hormone also promotes vasodilation, and we're going to see that that decreases blood pressure as well. So through both contractility effects on the heart and through vasodilation, this vascular event right here, that reduces blood pressure, and also its antagonistic effect on aldosterone reduces blood pressure. So here is a, I'm sure this is an exam figure right here, which is a nice flow diagram of how these concepts are interlinked with each other. So if you have increased blood volume, I'm not sure what water immersion is, to tell you the truth. I'll have to look up immersion. I guess that's when you have too much water in your body. That increases blood volume. So when your blood volume increases, you have more blood returning to the heart. That increases venous return. And where does venous blood return to the heart? What chamber? The atria, right? Both the right and left atrium. So, and in particular, the left atrium has stretch receptors in it. So they stretch and they directly then release atrial natriuretic hormone into the blood. That's a hormone that goes everywhere in the body, in particular to the kidneys. It increases sodium and water excretion. And when you excrete water and sodium, you lose that from your body. It goes into the urine. And that increases urine volume, that decreases blood volume, so there's less blood returning to the heart, so there's less venous return. So how does that compare to what the initial stimulus is? If there's less venous return and the initial stimulus was increased venous return, these two things subtract from each other, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism that reduces blood pressure. Okay, stretch on the atrium also stimulates, all right, or send signals via the vagus nerve to the brain, and in particular the posterior pituitary, and that then inhibits the secretion of antidiuretic hormone. So here is a neuroendocrine reflex that also takes place, which reduces ADH secretion, and we saw that that has an effect on the kidney, right? So ADH, antidiuretic hormone, produces what? It keeps you from producing urine, but if you cut back on ADH, then that will increase urine volume, and again, that will decrease venous return and decrease blood pressure as a result. Okay, some factors that affect blood flow, probably talked about this in lab quite a bit. Vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through an organ or tissue if the pressure is held constant. If the pressure decreases, then the flow decreases as well. But this statement right here just presumes that the blood pressure is going to be held constant. Vasodilation decreases resistance and increases blood flow. So there's an equation that you should just have memorized, right, in your mind, and that is, what are we talking about, blood flow right here? Blood flow. Okay, so blood flow I'm just going to write down as BF. And if we're going to write down an equation for blood flow, it's equal to two other parameters. What are these two other parameters? It's going to be blood pressure. All right, so as the blood pressure increases, what happens to blood flow since they are directly related? It increases, right? Okay, but we also have a parameter here in the denominator, and this is resistance, and I'm just going to put a big R right there. Resistance to blood flow, we put in the denominator, and that is mostly controlled by the diameter or the radius of a blood vessel. All right, so if the resistance increases, what happens to blood flow? It goes down because it's inversely related. All right, so this resistance term, because of Coisy's law or equation, just says if the radius changes, then resistance is going to change as a factor of a power of 4 of that change in the radius. All right, so vasoconstriction does the opposite. It increases resistance, so vasoconstriction increases R, which then decreases blood flow. So that equation I think you should have memorized in your mind. That's a nice basic equation. Okay, here is just a slide that shows you the percent of blood flow through various organs that are in your body. Notice that your kidneys require almost 20%. They're highly metabolic. They're working all the time. They're producing urine day and night. And if they ever stop producing urine, then they're dying. They're in failure. And, of course, then you could die as a result of that as well. Your kidneys are even much smaller than your brain, but require more blood flow than your brain. That's pretty amazing. Skeletal muscles, that seems to me to be a little bit high. Okay. And your heart, look how efficient your heart is. That's pretty amazing. All right, but I just want to focus on the kidneys right here. 20% of your cardiac output goes through your kidneys. Here we see an illustration of one circulation in your body. So this illustration is kind of handy because I could ask, how many chambers does the heart have? And you see it right there, right? So just memorize that. Just take a picture in your mind of that little diagram, and you see the two atria, the two ventricles. And this shows one circulation, okay? So the other thing that you can see is that we have two right chambers, two left chambers. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two, basically. It's got a right side and a left side. And then correspondingly, how many circulations are there in the body? There are two, right? There's a systemic and pulmonary circulation. And which one is illustrated on this diagram right here? So this is the systemic circulation, because systemic goes from the left ventricle through all the capillaries in the body with the exception of the lungs, and those tissues in your body take out oxygen and return relatively deoxygenated blood to the right atrium right here. So when I first looked at it, I thought, well, maybe this signifies the systemic circulation and this is the pulmonary circulation, but that's not really so. This is really the systemic circulation. Okay, so blood will flow from the left ventricle to the right atrium due to a pressure difference. So pressure is the reason why a fluid is going to move. Whether it's a gas or a liquid, it doesn't matter. It's always going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. So in order to get blood to flow in this loop right here, where does high pressure have to be? In the left ventricle, and low pressure in the right atrium. As a matter of fact, the pressure in the right atrium is very close to zero, and even at times it's a little bit below atmospheric pressure, so it really draws blood through the circulatory system. And it's the pressure difference that is the motive force, right? So it's not just a pressure, but it's a pressure difference on two ends of a tube that will make blood flow through it. So the change in pressure is 100 millimeters of mercury on average in the left ventricle. Okay, and it's zero in the right atrium, so that's the pressure difference, right? It's 100 millimeters of mercury. Okay, so if you do 120 over 80, that's systolic over diastolic, the mean is 100 millimeters of mercury. All right, so here we have blood flow equals to blood pressure divided by the resistance, just like what I have on the board. But remember, resistance has a number of important parameters in it, and that is that resistance is directly proportional to the length of a blood vessel. So the longer the blood vessel is, the more resistance it has. And so if you compare the pulmonary and systemic circulations, you see that the systemic circulation is much higher resistance because the blood vessels are a lot longer compared to the blood vessels that just have to take blood to and from the lungs. The resistance is also related to the viscosity of blood. And that changes with the number of red blood cells that are placed in blood. So if the hematocrit goes up, the viscosity of blood changes. And I know some athletes, would try to get a jump on their competitors by taking erythropoietin. Can anybody remember what erythropoietin is? What it does? Yeah, it's a hormone that stimulates red blood cell production, and an athlete will maybe take erythropoietin so that they have more red blood cells, so that your blood can carry more oxygen, under the assumption that you'd be able to perform better. But as your blood fills up with red blood cells, and that means that the hematocrit increases, then the blood becomes more viscous. It has trouble flowing through the blood vessels. So that counteracts the effect of taking that erythropoietin, unfortunately, if you're them, or maybe a good thing, so they don't have a untoward advantage over other competitors. Okay, and the other parameter that you should be really aware of is the radius of a blood vessel, and we see that right here. Okay, it's really in the denominator of the resistance term, and when you have a dilation of the radius right here, if the radius gets bigger, of course blood flow is going to increase, but it's not just, it doesn't scale exactly as the change in the radius, but the what? It's radius times radius times radius times radius. So if the radius changes by a factor of 2, how does blood flow change? And if everything else is held constant right here, if the blood pressure is held constant, viscosity and length of a blood vessel are all held constant, what happens to blood flow if the radius of a blood vessel changes by a factor of 2? Say it goes up by a factor of 2. What happens to blood flow? It goes up by a factor of, it increases by 2 times 2, which is 4, times 2, which is 8, times 2, which is 16. It's a very powerful and convenient way to regulate blood flow through blood vessels. It's just by changing their diameter through vasoconstriction or vasodilation. That's the most important effect. All right, here we see a plot of blood pressure in your body, and kind of at different times, I can see, of the heart cycle, but also at different blood vessels. All right, so we see, where do we have the highest blood pressure? In the left ventricle, you see it peaks at 120 millimeters of mercury, and then after ejection, the ventricle relaxes, and it plummets all the way down to 0, and then the ventricle contracts again, it goes up to 120 millimeters of mercury, and during that time it gets ejected from the heart into large arteries like the aorta, and there's a pulse in the aorta. When the heart ejects blood into it, the aorta expands a little bit, and as blood drains out of the aorta, that elastic tissue then compresses the blood and maintains blood pressure so it doesn't just drop to 0. But there's a blood pressure drop through small arteries, arterioles, because there is a lot of vasoconstriction or regulation that can take place in arterioles. And if there is resistance, then there's going to be a pressure drop. Some of the energy, the pressure energy, is going to be converted into heat, and there's going to be a pressure drop through arterioles. And then capillaries, a little bit lower pressure. These are very small vessels. There's no longer a pulse in capillaries. And then we get into venules and veins. So a good question is, what vessels have the highest blood pressure? Arteries. And which ones have the lowest pressure? And those are going to be veins. A lot of times the student just thinks, because capillaries are the functional part of the circulatory system, meaning that's where exchange takes place, that should be the area of a blood vessel that has the lowest pressure. But that's not really the case. Okay? Because if capillaries had the lowest pressure, where would all the blood end up? Would end up in capillaries and would never go back to the right atrium or an atrium to be pumped out of the heart again. All right, so veins have the lowest blood pressure, which draws blood into them, especially near the atria. Okay, what does this mean right here? Capacitance blood vessels. Veins are capacitance blood vessels, which means that with small changes in pressure, they can dilate very drastically, or they can constrict drastically if the pressure changes in those vessels. So small pressure changes can cause big changes in diameter of a vein, but not so of these resistance vessels right here. Right? They can't change the volume, but the volume in veins changes quite a bit depending on pressure. Let's take a look at a couple of these graphs right here. The first graph, we see surface area. This is just a cross-sectional area of a blood vessel. right? Just think of like a doorway. A doorway, of course, is not circular, it's rectangular, but a blood vessel is going to be circular. But we could measure the surface area of a circle with a ruler if we wanted to. Okay, and let's look at the surface, the cross-sectional area of the aorta versus and compare it to these other blood vessels. So we have cross-sectional area, or we have different blood vessels versus the cross-sectional area. We see that the cross-section of the aorta is pretty small, even though it's a huge blood vessel, right? It's relatively small, and then it bifurcates into smaller and smaller arteries. And then if you were to add up all the cross-sectional areas of these small blood vessels and add them together, then it's going to be greater than the cross-sectional area of the aorta. And the part of the vasculature that has the largest cross-section are these capillaries. Even though the diameter of every capillary is microscopically small, if we were to add up all those millions of capillaries that you have in your body, then it would turn into a huge doorway. Right, and then capillaries, anastomose, into venules, and the cross-sectional area decreases once again. And this corresponds, there's a physical principle that says if the blood flow into the aorta is going to equal the blood flow entering the vena cava right here, so it's the amount of blood entering and the amount of blood leaving, has to be the same. If we change the cross-sectional area, as the cross-sectional area increases, then the velocity of blood has to change to match the blood flow. So here we see the velocity of blood plotted out versus these different blood vessels. And you can see, as the cross-sectional area increases, then the velocity of the blood changes. All right, so this is not blood flow. How would you think of blood flow? What's the dimension of blood flow? Blood flow is, we have it right here, where's my little marker? Blood flow is going to be a volume, which is what? Centimeters cubed per time, like seconds. So the amount of blood, and what's a cubic centimeter? That's just a milliliter or a cc, right? Okay, this right here, velocity, is not blood flow, it's just the distance per time. How fast something travels, like your car, the speedometer on your car. And you can see that the blood, and I'm just have to tell you that the blood flow is constant through these different blood vessels, but the velocity changes because the cross-sectional area changes. So the velocity decreases until you get into the capillaries. And this is where blood is traveling the slowest through these blood vessels. And that makes perfect sense because what has to happen in these blood vessels right here? Exchange. And it requires time for exchange to take place. And so if blood were to occupy or be in a capillary for a short period of time, that would not allow for exchange. But because the velocity is slow, there is plenty of time for exchange. That's the whole point of this slide right here. All right, blood velocity is slow in a capillary because all the cross-sectional area is very, very large. All right, so what blood vessels have the slowest velocity? Capillaries, and that makes perfect sense because that's where exchange takes, and that's the important reason why, right? Because that's where exchange takes place. All right, let's look at blood pressure, okay? So you can look at that illustration on the board or the equation on the board. Arterioles play an important role in distributing blood and controlling blood pressure in your body. And as a matter of fact, you do not have enough blood to go everywhere to feed every capillary bed. So your body has to pick and choose where blood should go to maintain blood pressure. And if all the arterioles in your body were dilated at one time, you would just pass out because your blood pressure would drop. So blood flow to capillaries and blood pressure is controlled by the aperture or the diameter of arterioles, either vasoconstriction or vasodilation. And capillary blood pressure is decreased, okay, downstream from vasoconstriction. So here we just have, let's just think this is, kind of looks like a glass tube, but let's just think of it as like a plastic tube that we can constrict or compress, right? And if we produce a certain amount of pressure by putting fluid into this initial chamber right here, right, that pressure is going to force fluid out of the bottom of it and down the tube. And if we constrict this area right here, we're going to find that we have increased pressure in this region of the tube. And since blood can't get into this most distal segment over here, we're going to have decreased blood pressure. So we're going to have increased blood flow to these organs, that are upstream from the constriction of these arterioles and decreased in these arterioles over here. So this would be a good example, for instance, if these capillaries were going to your digestive tract and these capillaries were going to your brain and skeletal muscles, for instance, during exercise. When you start to exercise, then skeletal muscles and other reflexes will increase blood flow to the muscles by decreasing blood flow to the digestive organs. Okay, by vasoconstricting arterioles to your digestive tract. Right? And if we take this constriction away, what happens to blood flow to muscles? Okay, it goes down. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, because then that pressure is going to be distributed through other blood vessels in your body. All right, so capillary blood pressure is also low. It's not the lowest because of that cross-sectional area. So here we see that that the maximum cross-sectional area is in a capillary that we see on the diagram right here. All right, and we see a fairly large pressure drop through capillaries. It's probably the largest pressure drop as well because of the cross-sectional area. But it's a large pressure drop, but it's not zero pressure. Zero pressure is still in veins. All right, so three things that you should know about blood pressure. It's controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance in blood vessels. Sometimes we call this total peripheral resistance or peripheral resistance if we were to add up resistance of all the blood vessels in your body. These are the three things that you can use to think about blood pressure. Heart rate, stroke volume, so this has to do with the heart, and peripheral resistance has to do with blood vessels. All right, so it's kind of easy to understand that blood pressure will increase if your heart rate increases. I have a pretty good intuitive sense, and I think probably everybody in here would think that that would be true. If your heart rate increases, then it's pumping harder. What's going to happen to blood pressure? It should increase, right? It's directly related. And stroke volume, as the heart contracts with more force, what effect should that have on blood pressure? It should increase it as well, okay? This other term, peripheral resistance, is not so intuitive, but let's generate a nice equation that shows that. So here is an equation of blood flow is equal to blood pressure over resistance, right? We know that one for sure. But what else do we know about blood flow? Blood flow, cardiac output. What is blood flow? Is what? We said centimeters per second. Okay, a volume per second. But we also know another equation that has a volume per second, and that is what? Cardiac output. Cardiac output is equal to what? Stroke volume times heart rate. And stroke volume is what? The cubic centimeters per beat right here. Heart rate is what? Beats per minute. All right, the beats cancel out, so we're left with what? A volume per time, centimeters cube per minute right here. All right, if we want to consider blood flow, instead of seconds, we could convert that into minutes if we really wanted to. All right, so let's just put minutes right here. So blood flow and cardiac output really are the same thing. Right? Cardiac output is just the flow of blood leaving the heart, but that's got to equal the amount of blood returning to the heart, which is blood flow through various veins. So what do we know? We know from that then that blood pressure, since blood flow and cardiac output are equal to each other, we can say blood pressure divided by resistance is equal to stroke volume times heart rate, like so. And I'll turn the volume down. In a second, can I erase our cardiac output equation right here? We don't need that anymore. All right, but let's simplify this equation right here. How can we simplify this equation? Multiply both sides. Oops, that's close, but not quite. We multiply both sides of an equation by a constant. All right, that's no problem. So this R cancels out, and what are we left with? Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. And in this equation right here, what's the relationship with these three parameters to blood pressure? They're all directly related, right? So if stroke volume goes up, so does blood pressure. If heart rate goes up, so does blood pressure. And if resistance to blood flow increases, right, through vasoconstriction, so does blood pressure because of that. Okay, so if you just memorize the slide right here, it's not really intuitive, but after doing a little simple algebraic manipulation, it probably becomes a lot more intuitive for you. Okay, so an increase in any of these will result in an increase in blood pressure. Sympathoadrenal activity, sometimes I just call that an increase in sympathetic tone, raises blood pressure via arteriolar vasoconstriction. Because what does vasoconstriction do? Vasoconstriction increases resistance in a big way. Remember, it's a fourth power rule because of Poiseuille's equation. Right? And it also increases blood pressure because of increased sympathetic tone, increases heart rate, increases stroke volume. It increases all three of these parameters right here. So that's very powerful for maintaining blood pressure. Kidneys also play a role in regulating blood pressure by regulating blood volume and thus stroke volume. That was one of the things in the diagram in quiz today, right? So because of increased blood volume, we have increased end diastolic volume. The heart stretches more, and as the heart stretches more, it gets stronger in the normal heart, and that increases stroke volume. So just by increasing stroke volume, if everything else is held constant, that will increase blood pressure. So this is a pretty key slide for your understanding of regulation of blood pressure. Okay, the baroreceptor reflex. What do you use to measure pressure? What's it called? Like atmospheric pressure. You could have, oh, you have one in lab. Okay, a barometer, that's right. So anytime you hear that term baro, you should think of pressure or some kind of pressure measuring device. So a baroreceptor is a receptor in our body that can measure pressure, and in particular blood pressure, when we talk about the baroreceptor reflex. All right, it's activated by changes in blood pressure. And they are stretch receptors in the aortic arch and the carotid sinus. Can you remember where the carotid sinus is? Do I have a picture? Oh, I sort of have a picture. Here's the arch of the aorta. There's a baroreceptor right here, right? And then we've got the brachiocephalic, common carotid, and when the common carotid bifurcates to the internal and external carotid artery, there's a little bulge right here, a little ampule. We call this the carotid sinus. And there are stretch receptors right here that measure blood pressure. So this is just a nice reflex loop. We can see the afferent pathways. These are sensory fibers. I think maybe did you have to know one was a vagus and one was a glossopharyngeal nerve at one time? I forget. But anyway, these are the afferent pathways that bring that pressure information to the integration center, which is the cardioregulatory center in the medulla and the vasomotor center in the medulla. I don't know if I want to get too carried away about this slide. Let me go back right here. Sorry. Okay, that's fine. Let's just stay on this slide right here. All right, so here you have the afferent pathway to the integration center. What does the integration center have? Ooh, this is a blast from the first week of class. Blast from the past. The integration center has the set point, right? It has what normal blood pressure should be, all right? And if these signals are coming in and they're equal to what the set point is, what does the integration center have to do? Nothing. One of the things that an integration center does is makes a decision. It compares the stimulus to the set point, and if they're the exact same number, then the integration center says, well, your body's fine, no changes are necessary. But if the blood pressure is different than the set point, then the cardioregulatory center has to change the situation to bring blood pressure back to the normal range, right? What do we call that? That is homeostasis, right? Okay. So in this particular case, let's just say, and this diagram is maybe it's pretty good. I think it's pretty, let's work with the slide a little bit and then I'll see if there's an error on it. Let's just say that blood pressure is high. Okay, so the stretch receptors are increasing the frequency of action potentials to the medulla right here. So the medulla knows the blood pressure is too high. What would be a good solution? Okay. So it's going to decrease the activity of the heart. Now, what nervous system can decrease activity of the heart? Which one is inhibitory? the parasympathetic nervous system. But remember, the parasympathetic nervous system only goes to the atrium. It doesn't go to the ventricle right here. So it can only affect the chronotropy of the heart, which means it can only affect the heart rate. Can't affect inotropy, can't affect stroke volume. All right, so the heart rate slows down, and when the heart rate slows down, what's the effect on blood pressure? Decreases, so that's a nice negative feedback loop right there. Okay, and this happens very rapidly. So the baroreceptor reflex that we're illustrating on this slide right here is the most important mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure. So it's a reflex. It's a neuronal reflex. But long-term regulation, what regulates blood pressure in the long term? It's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. All right. So, and the only difference between them, they're very both important, but one acts over the long term and the other is just short-term regulation. Baroreceptor is short-term. All right. Now, let's just say blood pressure is dropping, like after class, after you're sitting there taking notes, you stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop, you might pass out. Right, your blood pressure is going to drop. It's picked up by these baroreceptors, sent to the medulla, cardioregulatory center. Cardioregulatory center compares it to the set point and says there's an error. Blood pressure is too low. What decision is the cardioregulatory center going to do under those circumstances? Yeah, it says, hey, we better increase blood pressure or this person's going to pass out. And then it's messy after that, right? The head bounces off the table, maybe off the chair, then on the floor. That's bad. So how can we increase blood pressure using this equation right here? We can increase a heart rate, right? Because sympathetic nervous system goes to the SA node, changes the slope of the pacemaker potential, increases heart rate. Sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricles, increases force of contraction. So these two parameters both increase blood pressure. And then there are also sympathetic nerves which are not shown, there is an error on the slide, that are not shown on this slide. There are sympathetic nerves that go to arterioles and veins to cause vasoconstriction. All right, and as veins and arterioles vasoconstrict, what happens to resistance? It goes up, right? So if resistance increases right here, what happens to blood pressure? All right, so all three of those effects take place as a result of the baroreceptor reflex. Okay, so I think that's basically all that I say right here. And the baroreceptor reflex is for short-term regulation, so it's most sensitive to decreases and sudden changes in blood pressure. Okay, here is an exam figure. I don't think this is an exam figure, but this one probably is. Is this the last slide? Ooh, last slide for this particular chapter. All right, so going from a lying position to a standing position, blood is going to pool in your extremities, especially your lower limbs, so less blood is going to return to the heart as a result. And if you have less blood returning to the heart, what about the end diastolic volume? It's going to go down, the heart stretches less, and as a result, then the stroke volume is going to go down. What would you use to explain this phenomena right here? As end diastolic volume decreases, stroke volume decreases, or the contractility of the heart decreases? What? Okay. There's a law. Yeah, it's named after two people. The Frank Starling Law of the Heart. That's an intrinsic property of the heart. As it stops stretching, the heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So as end diastolic volume decreases, stroke volume decreases. And if stroke volume decreases, what happens to cardiac output? These first two terms right here, it decreases. All right. And then if cardiac output decreases, then of course blood pressure decreases, and the baroreceptors are there to save our lives, and it sends that decreasing blood pressure signal to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla via these afferent neurons. There's a set point, don't forget, in the medulla, and the medulla and the integration center makes a decision to boost your blood pressure back up by increasing sympathetic tone and decreasing parasympathetic tone throughout the body. And increasing sympathetic activity will cause increased heart rate, increased cardiac output, increased blood pressure. How does it feed back to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it, right? and sympathetic activity on arterioles causes vasoconstriction that increases total peripheral resistance. And because of this equation right here, you can also see that it increases blood pressure as a result. All right, so that's the baroreceptor reflex. Now, before I put this slide away, everybody's got to read this term right here. Say it out loud. What is this right here? Baroreceptor reflex. I don't know. It just slides by a lot of people. Slid by me for decades. Okay, so baroreceptor reflex. But what is it? Most important, what? Mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure. Okay, baroreceptor reflex. So a lot of times you can just explain things very rapidly to people just by saying baroreceptor reflex. And they go, oh, nice. Okay, so that's it for this particular chapter. Any questions? Okay, you might want to be able to generate that equation right there or memorize this one and then you can figure out a lot of cardiovascular physiology. But you don't even have to memorize that one. Okay. I don't think I want to go over Poiseuille's law. I think you did that in lab, right? A bunch. But that's a really important law. You should know that one. If it's a little obscure to you, oh, I see what's going on here. Okay, stop by my office hours. But now remember, I won't be on campus on Monday and I won't be on campus on Tuesday of next week. So I won't be holding office hours on Tuesday, only on Thursday. All right, so now we're going to move to respiratory chapter. A couple little more equations right here. And on Tuesday, you'll finish this one up. But we can get started with it. Okay, a lot of this is review from anatomy. Respiration encompasses three functions in the body. Ventilation, and ventilation is just moving air in and out of your body, in and out of your lungs. Right, gas exchange, there are two places where gases are exchanged. One is in the pulmonary capillaries and the other is in systemic capillaries. So we're interested how oxygen and carbon dioxide move in and out of tissues, move in and out of the lungs. Right, and then also oxygen utilization. And we spent probably a week or two on oxygen utilization at the cellular level, producing ATP like through the electron transport chain. That's all considered respiration as well. All right, so cellular respiration sometimes is differentiated from mechanical respiration, which would be ventilation. All right, so ventilation just moves air in and out of your lungs. And then we have gas exchange between blood and the tissues through specialized vascular structures that we call capillaries, right? And things can exchange in a capillary because the wall of a capillary is very thin. So the way that gases are exchanged is through a process of diffusion, and diffusion works only for very short distances. So it won't work at all for long distances or moving through thick substances. And remember, diffusion is just passive. So how will a molecule move if it's just by passive diffusion? By concentration gradient, and it's going to go from high concentration to low concentration. Okay, some respiratory structures. Here we see a lower airway, your trachea that's held open all the time. That's a good thing because sometimes when you're hyperventilating, you have to pressurize your chest to get air out of your lungs. And when you pressurize your chest, the trachea, this tube right here, if it wasn't held open, would collapse and then air couldn't leave your lungs. Right? So it's got to be held open all the time. But what's the downside to have this trachea being held open all the time? Yeah, something could be dropped and it would fall right in the trachea and then you'll choke, right? Unlike other kinds of tubes that you have in your body. All right, the trachea comes down here to the carina where it bifurcates into a main bronchus, so just a smaller airway. These are held open as well. And you can see the right main bronchus is bigger than the left. And even the right lung is bigger than the left lung. And you could probably tell me why that is. Why is the left lung smaller than the right lung? Because you got your heart taking up some of that space in this cardiac notch right here. Okay, and then you get the smaller and smaller bronchi. All bronchi have cartilage that holds them open until you get down to some microscopic structures, and these are what we call bronchioles. Bronchioles no longer have cartilage on them, but they have smooth muscle that can constrict or dilate. And that's going to have the same effect on airflow as constricting a blood vessel. So when a bronchiole dilates, that allows more airflow through. When it constricts, it greatly reduces the amount of airflow through a bronchiole. If there's spasm of these small muscles right here, smooth muscles, then it severely restricts airflow through these respiratory bronchioles into this alveolar sac and into these alveoli where gas exchange takes place. Some respiratory bronchioles have alveoli on them, and this is the structure that allows for exchange because surrounding each alveolus is a network of capillaries. And your anatomy book has really nice pictures of those things, more so than your physiology book. Let's see what's on the next picture right here. All right, usually we consider the upper airway and the trachea and the bronchus and all of the bronchi, what we call the conducting zone, because gas exchange does not take place. But a respiratory zone is a place within the lungs where gas exchange can take place because it has alveoli. Like, for instance, on respiratory bronchioles and this alveolar sac right here, okay, and not a terminal bronchiole. There are no alveoli in a terminal bronchiole. If we look at an illustration of just an alveolus, this is what it looks like, or of a section of the lung at the level of an alveolus. I see a capillary right here with some red blood cells in it. Here is the alveolus with air inside the alveolus. And what kind of epithelium does this look like? The wall of the alveolus is made up of a simple squamous epithelium. And remember, that's specialized for exchange because it's a very short distance from the apical to the basal surface right here, so materials can diffuse across it very quickly. The same thing for a capillary. What kind of epithelium does a capillary have? It's just a simple squamous epithelium. As a matter of fact, since it's lining the tube or it makes the tube, we call it an endothelium, but it's basically the same thing. All right, so the wall of the capillary and the wall of the alveolus is very, very thin because they're just simple squamous epithelium. And then there's a little interstitial space, again, which is very short, so diffusion can take place very easily. All right, now inside the alveolus, there is water. And what can you tell me about water? Is it slippery or is it sticky? It's sticky because the water molecules are polar. One end of one water molecule likes to stick to the opposite end of the next one, right, because of the polarity and charge. So, water has a property called surface tension, right, which makes it sticky. So if you have a little saucer that you put a cup on, and you put another saucer right on top of it, if they're dry, you could just grab the top saucer and pull it off, and the bottom one would be heavy enough to be left on the table, right? You could separate them very nice and easily. Now, if you have water between those little plates, right, and you pick up just the top one, what's going to happen to the bottom one? Because of surface tension, they're going to stick together, and it actually be very difficult to separate the two plates unless you slide them off each other. You can do it that way. But if you're just going to move them apart by lifting vertically, it would be very hard to do it. You might even break the plates because of surface tension between the water molecules. Okay, so since there's water in the alveolus, if the walls of the alveolus touch each other, like for instance after exhalation, then the opposite sides of an alveolus will get glued together and they won't inflate. And indeed that happens to some people, puts them in respiratory distress. So there is a cell called a type 2 alveolar cell right here that secretes a fluid onto the surface of the alveolus, which is what we call surfactant, and basically it works like a soap or a detergent, and it breaks the surface tension between water molecules, makes the inside surface really slippery so that an alveolus can inflate very nicely. All right, a type 1 alveolar cell just makes the wall of the alveolus, but a type 2 secretes surfactant, and it's not till late term in gestation that these type 2 alveolar cells are mature, and they really don't become activated until the lungs experience, or actually the fetus experiences some stress, and then they start secreting surfactant. And what's a nice stressful experience for a fetus that will stimulate these cells? Yeah, parturition, just the process of being born, okay, which kind of activates their whole pulmonary function. So preterm fetuses and those that are delivered by cesarean section don't necessarily stimulate these cells into producing surfactants, so those neonates have trouble inflating their lungs. And then they just have to be put in an incubator, which has relatively high oxygen concentration, which helps, right, bring oxygen into these red blood cells right here. All right, the shape of a red blood cell is spherical, and that enhances exchange because we need a surface area for exchange. And have we ever talked about surface area in this class before? Did I measure this doorway? I think I did. I can't remember if I measured a doorway. Surface area, okay, of this piece of paper, okay, is just the width times the height. And we could measure it in inches, multiply the inches of the height times the width, and we get the surface area in inches of this piece of paper. Right, we could measure the surface area of this table with a ruler the same way, and you can see that the table is what? A greater surface area than this piece of paper right here. Or we could go over to this door right here and measure the surface area of the door, because I got a nice meter stick right here. How would we calculate the surface area of this door? Measure the width. And look at this nice fancy door. It's exactly 1 meter wide. And how tall is it? Maybe I didn't do this for everybody. Okay. Well, it's 1 meter. Okay. And then I'll put my finger right here. And then we'll measure it a second time right here. And look. Oh, it's exactly 2 meters as well. That's fortunate because it's easy to multiply. 2 times 1 is what? 2 square meters for that doorway. That's just the surface area of that doorway. How many people could walk through that doorway at one time? One comfortably, but 2, 3, I mean, if you've got a head start, maybe 4, okay, 3 people, okay, 3 people through that doorway. But if we make that doorway bigger, like a garage door, how many people can we get through a garage door at one time? A lot, 30, 40 people maybe. So as the size of the doorway increases, the exchange increases, right? So as the surface area increases, what can you tell me about exchange? It increases as well. All right, so in order to get gases from the outside world into our body, we need a large surface area to do that. So if we take all the alveoli, and there's about 300 million alveoli in the lungs, and think of them like peeling a grape and take the skin of these grapes and flatten them all out on a table, right? We'll just take a little alveolus and put it here and the next one here, flatten them all out. Okay, what would be the size of that tabletop? And it would be 80 square meters, right? Which is, I think 80 square meters, that's about half of a tennis court, the size of a half of a tennis court. That's the doorway for exchange. So when you think of surface area, I want you to think of doorway. Surface area, that's an area for exchange. And as the doorway increases, then exchange increases. So evolution has figured out a really nifty way to take this huge surface area, like half of a tennis court, and shrink it down inside of our thoracic cavity. And why is that really cool? Yeah, because I couldn't imagine being as wide as a tennis court and half as tall just so that I could breathe if it was just a flat membrane right there. Okay, so if we look at the wall of the alveolus, this interstitial space, and I'm sorry, the wall of the capillary, the interstitial space, and the wall of the alveolus right here, along with some of that surfactant, I like to call that the respiratory membrane. That's the membrane that oxygen and CO2 have to cross to get from the air in the alveolus to inside the blood right here. Okay, some books just say the wall of the capillary interstitial space and the wall of the alveolus, but I don't want you to forget about that surfactant that lines the wall of the alveolus. Okay, there are also pores between alveoli that help equalize pressure so that all the alveoli inflate at the same time. The conducting zone right here just warms and humidifies the air, and it also cleans the air as you breathe in, because I don't think I have a picture of it, but if we have a nice histological section of the trachea, you would notice that it's a nice pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, and with goblet cells, the goblet cells secrete mucus into the trachea, which then traps dust particles and bacteria and other kinds of microscopic debris, and that otherwise would end up in your lungs and possibly plug your lungs up. But those cilia then sweep that mucus in which direction? That's right, up into your oral cavity, And then once it's there, what happens? Well, yeah, you just swallow it down. Okay. And here it says expectorated. I suppose if you're a baseball player, you can relate to that. Okay, because they're spitting all the time. But normally we don't do that. Okay, thoracic cavity. You know where the thoracic cavity is. I don't think I'm going to talk about that. But let's review something about the membranes around cavities that are not open to the outside world. Remember, there are two major kinds of membranes. One kind of membrane lines the cavity that's open to the outside world. The other membrane lines the cavity that's not open to the outside world. And you should know the names of each of those two. Which one's which? Which is the one that's open to the outside world? That's a mucous membrane, like lining your oral cavity, nasal cavity, digestive tract, that's a mucous membrane, reproductive tract, urinary tract, all those tracts are open to the outside world. They have a mucous membrane around them. Some secrete mucus, but that's not necessary to be called a mucous membrane. And then the second kind, a little bit more complicated, is a serous membrane. We have a serous membrane that makes the pericardium or the pericardial cavity. We have a serous membrane that makes the pleural cavity. Those are all examples of serous membranes. Your lungs are not open to the outside world, at least on the outside they're not, and the heart is not open to the outside world, so it has a serous membrane. The membrane around the lungs in particular is called the pleural membrane, and it's got three parts. The part that's right on the surface of the lung, and it kind of, I guess, looks blue to me right here. It follows every little sulcus and crease on the surface of the lungs. That's what we call the visceral pleura. So the lungs are the visceral, is a visceral organ, and that membrane that's right on top of it is called the visceral pleura. All right, and then it moves around over here, and we see it lining the surface of the lung till it gets back over here, and it makes a nice hairpin turn and comes around this way and lines the surface of the thoracic wall. All right, it's continuous. It's the same membrane. It hasn't stopped and regenerated itself. It's the same membrane, but it's in a different location. So the membrane that's on the body wall right here is what we call the parietal division of the pleural serous membrane. The visceral division is right over here, and you can see a space between them, and that's just the pleural cavity filled with serous fluid or pleural fluid. Okay, so these are the different spaces, okay, that we have in the lung. You have the pleural lining right here, and you get this pleural space. Now, this is a watery fluid in the pleural space. And do you think it would be a good idea to have surfactant in this space right here, or just keep it a watery solution? And it's really important that it doesn't have surfactant, and nobody has surfactant in this space right here. And that water then actually helps glue the wall of the thorax to the lung, so that when the thoracic cage expands, it actually pulls on the lungs and helps the lungs inflate. If there was surfactant, then the thoracic cavity could expand without pulling on the lung tissue right here, and it might not inflate as a result of that. So serous fluid does not have surfactant, but inside of an alveolus, there is plenty of surfactant that allows for inflation. All right, so the lungs inflate because of pressure differences, right? Air moves from high pressure to low pressure. Lungs are very compliant. They're actually amazing. I don't think we've ever worked with any live animals in lab. Yes, we did, but we didn't hurt them. We didn't open up their thoracic cavity and look at their lungs. But a little rat lung, when it's not filled with air, kind of looks like the tip of your finger. And then when it's filled with air, it's like almost as big as your whole hand. It just expands greatly. It just is amazing when you see that happen. So that means that it's highly compliant. The volume of a lung expands drastically when there's a small change in pressure within the lungs. Lungs are also elastic, so that when the pressure decreases, guess what happens to a lung? After it stretches out and that pressure is released, it just automatically shrinks back down to its original size because of the elasticity. Okay, and that surface tension of the lungs influences the ease of ventilation, actually the decrease in surface tension. Okay, so don't forget about this elastic component right here. The intrapulmonary and intrapleural pressures. Let's see if we can figure out where these are. I typically forget where these things are. Okay, we said that there is no surfactant in the serous fluid, which helps attach the lungs to the thoracic wall. This is true, right? But there's also very low pressure in the pleural space, right? And I think that's what we're going to call the intrapleural pressure. Let's take a look. Intrapleural space contains a thin layer of watery, sticky, lubricating fluid. Okay, the intrapulmonary pressure, that's the pressure inside the lungs. Transmural pressure is the pressure difference between the pressure inside the lungs and the pressure in that pleural space is the transmural pressure. And that's what keeps the lungs inflated. So let's take a look at this slide right here. Let me go to the next one right here. All right, so the intrapulmonary pressure, this is pressure inside the lungs. The transpulmonary is across the lungs, and the intrapleural pressure is the pressure in the intrapleural space. And during inspiration, okay, the intrapulmonary pressure decreases because of Boyle's law, which is what we're going to look at. The intrapleural pressure remains below atmospheric pressure, so that means that the transpulmonary pressure from inside to outside the lung increases, and that allows air to flow inside the lungs. Okay, on expiration, right, the intrapleural pressure is still negative, so the lungs are still expanded up against the chest wall. The intrapulmonary pressure is high because of Boyle's law, which we're going to look at on the next slide. So the transpulmonary pressure increases to +6. So expiration takes place. All right, so these pressures right here are not absolute pressures, but pressures above and below atmospheric pressure, which is about, 760 millimeters of mercury. All right, so let's see how these intrapulmonary pressures change. It's due to Boyle's law, which is equal to, pressure is equal to 1 over the volume. Some of you that have maybe taken chemistry know this as the ideal gas law, and one right here is replacing some constants and temperature. All right, the ideal gas law is PV equals NRT. All right, but we're going to just presume that NRT, we don't change temperature, and we're not changing other things in the lung, so we're just going to call that a constant 1. And we can get rid of V over here on this side of the equation by dividing both sides of the equation by V. So pressure is inversely related to volume. So if the volume of a container decreases, what happens to pressure since it's inversely related? If volume decreases, then pressure increases. Or if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? Okay? That if the volume increases, then the pressure decreases. All right, so this implies that changes in intrapulmonary pressure occur as a result of changes in lung volume. Right, pressure of a gas is inversely proportional to the volume, which is Boyle's law right here. Okay, so an increase in lung volume decreases the intrapulmonary pressure. And so there are muscles that increase lung volume. It would be nice to have a picture. I don't have a picture of it. Okay, so here is the diaphragm. And in this particular condition, the diaphragm is relaxed and it's forming a nice dome right here. When it's stimulated into contracting, it becomes flat. The dome is flattened out, and thus the size of the thoracic cavity increases by this area right here that I'm circling. So when the diaphragm contracts, the volume of the thoracic cavity increases. What happens to the pressure inside the lungs when the diaphragm contracts and increases the volume? Okay? When the thoracic cavity size increases, all right, then the pressure decreases. And when that happens, what happens to the size of the lungs? Then they inflate as a result. Okay, when the diaphragm relaxes, it goes back to this dome shape that decreases the volume of the lungs. All right, so that means the pressure inside the lungs increases, that forces air out. Right, and the reason why that the diaphragm goes back to this dome shape is because of the elastic properties of all skeletal muscle. Right, and something else happens during that process, and that is the elastic properties of the lungs also cause air to be expelled. And as a matter of fact, inspiration, okay, is due to contraction of the diaphragm, and exhalation is caused just by relaxation. No muscles are necessary for expiration. Expiration for what we call quiet breathing is completely passive, and it's just due to the elastic properties of the diaphragm and the lung tissue itself. So elastic properties of the lung are hugely important. Which is just what I said right here. Elastic tension increases during inspiration, is reduced by recoil during expiration. So expiration is a passive process. Inspiration is an active process. And we've talked about surface tension already. Okay, and I don't think I want you to understand the physics of this, okay? But what's really important, what surface tension does is not only does it allow an alveolus to expand, but if surface tension were high in the lung, okay, it would allow large alveoli or parts of the lung that were expanded to receive more air compared to other parts of the lung that were not inflated. And as a matter of fact, parts of the lung that were hardly inflated at all would lose pressure, and all of that air would go into a part of the lung that was expanded. So that would just mean that the lungs would never be able to expand so that they would work as a lung. You'd have one alveolar sac receive all of the air, and it would expand and rip apart. But because that surface tension is decreased due to surfactant, then all of the alveoli have the same tendency and ability to inflate. So that's really what the law of Laplace says. Okay, we talked about surfactant already. We didn't talk about these conditions that are produced by inappropriate or inadequate amount of surfactant. Right, respiratory distress syndrome in premature babies, right, and acute respiratory distress syndrome in adults, okay, that are in septic shock due to some kind of systemic infection, produces similar kinds of symptoms. Oh, there's a nice picture. Okay, well, I'm going to have your guest lecturer begin right here, mechanics of breathing, for next time. Ah, one last thing. This right here, pulmonary volume chart. This is an important exam figure, so make sure you look at that one and go over that one. Nicely, and gas exchange. Okay, some of these figures are important exam figures, like I think this one is right here. All right, so that's it. Then on a week from today, we'll maybe finish some of this up. I might go through some of these saturation curves and move on to urinary system on Thursday. This spirometry diagram. This is probably an important one. The saturation curve is important. This one with 2-3 dpg is important. CO2 transport is important. So next time you should know how oxygen is transported in the blood and how CO2 is transported in the blood. Two different ways.